Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Greg Bogert, who is the author of In the Company of Sages, The Journey of the Spiritual Seeker. Greg has extensive experience in being associated with masters and meditation and spiritual seeking. And I think that his book is one that we can all learn from. Thanks, Greg, for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
So would you like to give our audience a little bit of your background and how you became, how you came to the spiritual path?
Absolutely. It started when I started practicing yoga at about age 14. My mother had a 28-day yoga book. It was a program, 28 days. So I did that, and then I started practicing TM back in 1973, and then I got into Iyengar yoga. I started reading Iyengar's book, Light on Yoga, and that book really set me on fire, and I started doing a lot of intensive hatha yoga practices. And as I got farther into that, meditation became more compelling, and I ended up meeting Swami Muktananda, who was staying two blocks from my high school in 1974. And something about his influence caused me to really delve deeply into meditation, shed some bad habits, and got very focused on spirituality and meditation. And that led me into studying world religions at Wesleyan, and from there, I was also a musician and a music teacher starting out, and I started joining together music and counseling, because as people were learning music and singing, it would bring up deeper emotional issues, self-doubts and lack of confidence and so forth. So gradually I also became aligned with counseling, and I became a professional astrologer, which was another facet of my my path. Mm-hmm. And eventually ended up in a four-year teacher training at the Iyengar Yoga Institute of San Francisco. My yoga path combined several components. I was also trained by a teacher in New York City named Alan Bateman, a very unusual character. So my yoga teaching started to combine the Iyengar method, the Bateman technique, which is basically a method of liberating the spine, and a very gentle approach to yoga, and then meditation. So that's been my my way ever since. And so that's how I got started.
Well, you were exposed then to probably the two greatest Eastern masters that were directed to the U.S. That was the Maharishi with TM, and then Yogananda with his amazing story. And that was great that you had that start. You were right at the right time for that to happen. It's interesting that did this all take place in California for you?
Oh, I was in New York City.
I was in New York City,
and there were a lot of teachers moving through New York that I had to meet, Pir Vilayat Khan and Chogyam Trungpa and many others. And so my early life was on the East Coast, and then I moved out to California in 1986.
Great. Now, your guru is Shri. How do you pronounce that?
Muktananda was my main guru.
Okay. Oh, okay. So Yogananda was the main guru, and then his guru was Shri.
Kishwar. But
Kishwar,
I didn't really have a personal connection with that that lineage.
I spent a huge amount of time reading the book that his master wrote. I think it was called The Holy Science.
Yeah,
is that right?
Book.
I mean, that book was one of the most incredible books I ever read. And then, of course, I read Autobiography of the Yogi, but I never was able to connect with him.
Well, what was remarkable about that book was showing how his teacher guided him step by step into your life. Such a beautiful, beautiful story.
Now, I did meet Ram Dass. I had a video production company. We did a whole hour video in Ram Dass, and it was interesting. We were in the kitchen talking, and Ram Dass had a misunderstanding about plastic surgery. He was saying, you know, in his mind, it was just cosmetic. And I said, well, that's not actually true. You know, half my practice is hand surgery. I do a lot of facial trauma. And so he apologized profusely for thinking that plastic surgery was only cosmetic, which I guess is a common misconception. But his interview was wonderful. The one that we did with him.
He was incredible. Teenager in my 20s, I was just wild about Ram Dass. I just read everything I could about Ram Dass and listened to every tape I could get my hands on. That guy's great.
Yeah, he really was. Well, tell us a little bit about, because there's a lot of people doing spiritual practices in the U.S., a lot of people doing meditation, yoga, but there's not that many people who actually have the experience of a living guru. You know, that's something that is less common. And I think what I'd like to do is introduce the audience to that concept and what it is, and then, of course, what it isn't. You know, in your book, you talk about having this argument with your parents that I had the same argument with my parents, by the way. You know, they thought I was being in a cult, and they thought I was being unduly influenced by all these weird things like becoming vegetarian and meditating and doing spiritual practices. So, you want to address that a little bit, how at least our parents' generation were really fearful of this path for us.
They had reason to be somewhat skeptical or fearful. They were false teachers, and there were and are cults that may or may not be that healthy for people. But it's also true that spirituality has always been passed on from teacher to student. It's always been something that one is initiated into. And it is possible to learn, you know, on one's own. One of my teachers, Alan Bateman, was self-taught. Ramana Maharshi was self-realized without a teacher. Mm-hmm. But many people find that the teacher can be a conduit for some important transmission, some important knowledge, and also a living example. And so we in the West may be a little skeptical of the whole idea of a student-teacher relationship of this kind, an initiatic relationship, but it's been known in all religions and all paths and is respected. So the reason I wrote this book, there were several facets of it. It actually started out, I was talking about separating from a teacher. The book's inception was talking about the conflicts people face when they've been involved with a spiritual teacher and they decide to move on or leave that teacher. Mm-hmm. But I broadened the discussion to talk about all phases of this relationship, including what it is that impels us to seek out instruction, to seek out an example of meditation, to feel vibrationally what it's like to be in meditation, and to take instruction to seek their initiation and guidance, and to become more deeply involved in lifestyle changes that are conducive to awakening. So in these ways, teachers can be extremely helpful to us. They were pivotal in my development, but what also needs to be looked at is the emotional dynamics of the relationship, which changes over time. And this is what people sometimes don't get, that there may mm-hmm. be a phase to be highly and deeply committed or devoted to a teacher, and that's what a lot of our friends or family members may not understand, why we're mm-hmm. so excited about a particular teacher or teaching, that we were really give ourselves over to it deeply. And then there may come a later time when we need to develop in other areas, such as our work or our personal relationships or our creativity. where we need the less of the direct influence of the teacher, where it's time to individuate and emerge out of that that relationship, out of that devotional commitment. Am I making sense to you, Susan?
I'm sorry? Yeah, that's fine. I had the opportunity to meet a number of Realized Masters. One of my spiritual students was bringing them to Atlanta to do workshops and in this particular thing. And there were, I think, about six of them that came through town once a month. And she would tag me to go out to dinner with them on the Friday night before the before their presentation started. And I had not really met masters before, but I can tell you that masters have a very, very different energy field, and that the energy field or the light coming out of their eyes is very similar, master to master. And that's, I mean, you talk about that in your book about the, the energy, and specifically how even when you're not in the company of your master, the energy transfer can occur. And would you like to talk a little bit about what this energy is? Because it is similar in each master, and where it's coming from and why that is. I guess that's one of the things that is the same in each master, is this energy. Because each of them have different personalities. They have different, they have different styles. You know, like you say in your book, some of them are rougher on the student than others. And Yogi Bhajan used to go around cussing all the time, and people thought that masters didn't cuss, but of course they do if they want to. But that energy was what struck me as being able to identify who is a master.
Well, I don't know that they all have the same energy. I can't say that I know that. What I know is that you meet someone who sets something alive inside you. You feel something change inside. You could mm-hmm. feel love, tranquility, power, and shakti, energy movement. It might mm-hmm. be different with different teachers, and there are different levels of teachers that can help us. So some of them are not fully realized masters, such as my yoga teacher, Alan Bateman, but mm-hmm. still can be remarkably helpful and liberating. So one of the topics in my book is receiving knowledge and information or guidance from teachers of different levels, that's perfectly okay. Not each of them is like a saint or something. Some of them may mm-hmm. just instruct us in methods or techniques that can be helpful. And then other teachers, such as the ones you're referring to, have reached a higher enfoldment of their human capacities and embody a profound love or spacious consciousness that taps that potential in us. So we see a reflection of who we could be, and it evokes a kind of awe and gratitude. And that's what I devote my book to, is talking about that process and what it means to align with the teacher, to emulate them, to follow the path they show, and to absorb teachings from different people. Maybe not only one teacher is needed. Maybe we need teachers in different areas, different capacities. So Muktananda was a profound meditation teacher, but I needed to be trained in working with the body, posture, breath, mm-hmm. As a preparation for deeper meditation. And another facet of the book is talking about the person who is in the role of the teacher. In other words, the book was written as a manual for a teacher training program, a yoga teacher training. So I try mm-hmm. to address what are the challenges of people who are stepping into that role, trying to help others awaken. What are the tests and challenges that teachers can anticipate? What kind of maturity do they need to develop and exhibit in their human relationships? So the book is exploring this student-teacher dynamic really from both sides. the evolving student who is maturing and individuating and unfolding in their own way, and then the teacher who has responsibilities to students, and also the opportunity to keep growing, to not be static and complacent in their development. So it's the only book I know of that does that, that looks at it from both sides and talks about the psychological elements of projection and maturation that allows us to eventually, you know, love a teacher, but live in our own way, you know, live our own embodiment, develop our own uniqueness.
So you're the book says that you're a practicing psychotherapist. Is that still true?
It is true. I'm a psychotherapist and a counseling astrologer and a professor of psychology, all three.
Would you like to give your contact information so if the listeners want to look up your information, they can?
Oh, absolutely. First, two websites, www.gregbogart.net is my psychotherapy site. Then www.dawnmountain.com, D-A-W-N, dawnmountain.com. It describes all my writings and publications and astrological services. And my email is gbogart7@sbcglobal.net.
So you're, are you currently with a master that you're... or have you separated from the master, or what is the status right now for you?
Well, my teachers are inside me, and I'm satisfied. I've drunk from the well, so I don't feel a need for a living teacher right now, because I had my astrological teachers, my hatha yoga teachers, and my meditation teachers. So I just try to do my practices, and that's where I find the guru. I find the guru in breath practices and in mantra and in music and asanas. So that's what I would say is I know I'm at this time not studying with a particular teacher. Now, I have great love for some teachers, like Judith Lasseter has taught me so much. She's a great hatha yoga teacher. And but right now, teaching is more my practice. Teaching psychology, psychology of yoga, depth psychology, developmental psychology, and but I continue to meditate. And that's where I meet the guru. That's what my teachers told me to do, and so that's the current state of things.
Yeah, I always knew that my teacher, my internal teacher, was Master DK of the, you know, the Alice Bailey DK. And he seems to be over a lot of the healers. So that's who I take instruction from for the big things, you know, the big things in the path of life. And although I've met a lot of teachers, I haven't really studied under any of them. But I've always been fascinated because a lot of my friends were Sai Baba devotees and other, you know, had other incredible masters, and all the experiences were really amazing to me.
Yeah.
It's just incredible. So there's a lot in your book about that I enjoyed reading about.
Well, the book recounts my experiences with several teachers, and some of those lessons are still resonating, you know, decades later, 40 years later. And had a beautiful teacher, Swami Muktananda, who unfortunately got wrapped up in scandals at the end of his life.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunate. But the resonance of the times I had with him stays with me. So sometimes you only meet a teacher once, and that can inspire you.
Right.
It can be an enlivening darshan. But what I also think is it's the intense seeking, the longing of us as seekers that brings teachers to us, magnetizes guidance, instruction, and liberating transmission. So if you're sincerely looking inward and in need of that sparking of your soul, it can happen. You can find it.
Right.
But, that's been my great happy discovery.
So do you think that there are, I know there's teachers that go through the U.S. touring. Do you think that one can find teachers here in the U.S., or is it better to go overseas to seek teachers? Do you have a
I think there's teachers everywhere. I don't think there's a unique copyright on teachers in India or Tibet, although those countries have cultivated spiritual masters and mastery through their cultural traditions over centuries.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a lot of great teachers here, and some of them are emerging in our midst. Some of them are young people emerging now. Maybe they're not fully grown masters, but they're alive with the fire of yoga and meditation, and they can inspire people. So it's really, the key is practice for all of us at whatever stage we're at. Do the refining of consciousness through meditation, breath awareness, purification, hatha yoga, or other methods of prayer and evoking higher consciousness. And Americans are different. You know, we're individualists. We're less easily swayed into devotional connection to teachers. That's the part that our families, our parents, had a hard time with. They didn't want us surrendering to someone who might have power over us and misuse that influence. And so, you know, their concern for us was well-placed and well-meaning. It's just that sometimes we choose to put ourselves in the path of the fire, you know, of the living teacher, who may be very intense. And sometimes very difficult. Not all teachers have pleasant, useful personalities, as you were recounting a few minutes ago.
Right.
Teachers can make us uncomfortable in the ways they challenge us. So that's one of the topics in my book, is the tests that teachers will place in our path, ways they challenge us, they confront us with certain limitations or neurotic traits, and try to help us, you know, better ourselves. But at the same time, teachers go through tests. They test our trust in them quite a bit. And the reason we do this is that there may be glimpses of the goal, glimpses of a vaster horizon of consciousness. So chapter 6 of my book is on glimpses of the goal. And the moments that take us to the threshold of our own awakening through a teacher's assistance. And that assistance may be something as formal as a practice, a discipline, a sadhana that they give us and instruct us in, or it can be something non-tangible. It's just something that they magnetically convey in their presence. That's the mystery of the guru. That's the part that's hard to explain rationally. You know, and how is it that some teachers know us from inside? They know our minds. They're so psychically sensitive and evolved that they can be telepathically connected to us. That was my experience with my teacher. That's what was amazing and mystifying, is how he knew me from within. And so what does it mean to realize the inner consciousness that is shared by all beings? That's, I think, going back to what you were questioning or describing earlier, is that they have become a living consciousness that is...
it's the same master to master. Yeah. I want to tell a story, if I can. I had a a radio show for 22 years, but a TV show for 6 years. And I interviewed Barbara Gardner, who wrote a book called The Psi Prophecy. And she has a story that illustrates what you were talking about with this, the effect of the master on the student. She and her husband was very spiritual, but she was more of a university teacher, kind of left-brained and, you know, more in 3D than spiritual practices. And she went over to visit Sai Baba in India, and of course he called her and her husband out of the thousands of people for a private audience. And he was sitting there talking to her husband through the translator, and she said that she couldn't even talk. Her heart was opening, and it was so uncomfortable and so, you know, emotional for her. And of course she was not an emotional person, that all she could do was just sit there and just try to, you know, maintain herself. And at the end of it all, he said to her, "That book that was given to you, write it and I shall bless it." She was actually given the entire book, The Psi Prophecy, in a dream before she ever went there.
Wow, that is incredible.
Isn't it a neat story? But she said her heart opening was what was important, because if it hadn't opened, she probably wouldn't have been able to write the book. But The Psi Prophecy is a wonderful story about the soul's tapestry through multiple lifetimes, and how we really have a... I think it's one of the most interesting books, and I do believe that Sai Baba gave it to her, because it's unlike any other book I've ever read. And of course, the end of the book is about ascension, so it's a really special book for this time to understand what ascension is. The Ark of the Covenant is actually the ignition for the ascension, according to Sai Baba, which I also had heard that from other sources. So, but it was just very, very interesting to hear her transformation. She didn't even say anything to him. She just was, you know, her heart was opening. And then you had an interesting experience, which I think is a really, really important lesson that each of us every day can practice, whether or not we have a living master or just the master within. And that's when you were confronted by that guy that was kind of angry and demanding money from you. You want to tell that story? I think that's a great story.
You know, it's funny. I'm not recalling the story you mentioned.
It was the one where normally you would have been fearful of him because his eyes were angry.
Oh, yes. Okay,
But you did something else that softened him.
Well, what you're describing is how in the 1980, I was living in New York City, 1979, early 1980, and I saw this homeless man down in the lower Greenwich Village, and he was a very... he was scary to me. He was just a very large, disheveled, dirty, smelly homeless person who unfortunately hadn't had a shower in a while. And I recall that when he asked me for money, I was able to just have a moment where I remembered meditation. I took a breath. I tried to not be afraid of him, and I spoke to him. And I just sort of inquired about him, you know, was he okay? And it was awfully cold out. And he was very touched. He just said that no one had been kind to him in a long time. And, you know, I gave him a little money and was on my way. But what I think I was recounting in the story was how we find the result of our spiritual practice in unexpected ways in the course of daily life. So I'm not saying this was anything amazing for me to accomplish, but it was a shift where ordinarily I would have been paranoid and I would have been walked on the other side.
Well, you were seeing the God in him what you were doing.
Yes, where I ordered,
and that's what the masters teach us to do. Right,
was unguarded and had a touching human connection for a moment. So. That was because of meditation. I was just able to be still enough for a moment to see the light in another suffering human being.
I had a similar experience. I was getting gas, and I was pulling out on the highway, and you know how sometimes somebody will stop and motion you to go on, and you do it, but, you know, it's probably not a good idea because somebody else is coming, and you almost hit him, right? Something like that. So that happened, and the guy that that almost hit me was in a black truck, and he had, like, a gun rifle, and, you know, he was obviously very angry. So I pulled back in to the gas station, and he came over, and he started banging on my car. And so I lowered the window a little bit, and I apologized to him. I said, you know, I'm sorry, I didn't see you. And so he was, but I was guided from within to just start sending him massive amounts of love, just, you know, just the energy of love. And so he backed up, and he went over, and he started banging on his truck. I mean, he was taking his anger out on his own truck, but he left me alone. So that's the power of love.
That's a great story.
It can really protect you in dangerous situations. It really can. So. So would you like to tell us any other information about the book?
Well, this book was originally written as a text to give developing yoga teachers and meditation teachers some understanding of what the traditional role of spiritual teachers has been. And also to celebrate this still living path for self-development through spiritual apprenticeship and its different stages. So what I think remarkable is how all world religions have inspiring teachers that people have followed and admired and been devoted to, and how we're trying to carry that on in our own culture, but where we have a much different attitude towards authority. We're much more skeptical or suspicious of unquestioning devotion and those traditions that were prevalent in certain Asian cultures, and where you never questioned a teacher, where now we do so. So I try to look at this as a celebration of a tradition and an invitation for people to embrace it themselves, to find a teacher, to find a trustworthy guide who is a vehicle for instruction, but also who just inspires us inwardly. And I talk about how this was practiced in Judaism and Buddhism and Sufism, Hinduism, and I tell my own story. That's the most I have to offer, is what happened to me, what has been happening inside me, gifts received from teachers, what it means to connect to a lineage, feel part of a living chain of beings through time, and to identify kind of what our lineage is and what we gravitate to. So, for example, I've studied Buddhism for 40 years, but I'm really not a Buddhist practitioner. That's not really my way so much. So we find the practice that's right for us, not what everybody else thinks is cool, and being willing to test out different teachers to find who we resonate with.
Right.
I talk about this remarkable experience called Shaktipat, when a teacher accepts us and bestows a certain blessing that is nonverbal. It's an energy transmission. It awakens the kundalini.
Right.
A descent of grace, and how that accelerates spiritual practice. But what I also believe is that awakening can happen through intensive practices of our own, intense devotional prayer, intense meditation, intense hatha yoga and pranayama practices. Start to build the living fire inside us. However, teachers are needed at different stages. So I talk about how I started doing pranayama as a kid. It teenager, and how I passed out one time because I did a breath of fire and a ball of light exploded in my head, and I passed out in my living room, you know, at age 8.
Right.
And I realized I was over my head. I needed help to know what is the right way to approach this that's safe. So I'm really into people finding instructions, learning how to do yoga properly, learning a good natural approach to meditation. And so I describe what happened when I received initiation at age 16 mm-hmm. and 17, and how incredible the meditations were. And but I also talk about how we have to unfold in life. We have to unfold all parts of ourselves, not just the spiritual practices, and how work, creativity, relationships, gardening, you know, cooking meals, many facets of life become yogas in their own right, and so that we broaden our understanding of what spiritual practice is, and how also we may combine practices, combine different interests into our own spiritual way. So for me, it combines hatha yoga, meditation, music, astrology, and psychotherapy, dreams, and dream work. I've written two massive books on dreams, which also are a kind of guidance from the unconscious mind. So I talk also about fierce teachers, teachers who are very grouchy or have very strong egos or personalities that may make us, well, what I think is some of those teachers can inspire us with their self-confidence. That's how I choose to view it. Mm-hmm. You know, some people think someone like Bikram Choudhury has a huge grandiose ego. The way I look at it is he's a teacher of high self-esteem.
That's, uh-huh.
You know, I think there's something positive in that. I also talk about unhealthy teachers, unhealthy communities of practitioners, and false teachers, false messiahs. How do we discern who's real, who's uh-huh. deluded?
Right.
And so that's a big topic. And I talk about the way a real teacher just generates in us the desire to practice, to meditate, to go within, to be still,
right.
to be whole, to be in union. And someone like Ram Dass, you know, he just exudes that, and everybody who hears him wants to pursue the great way. So the book is a celebration of the path of studying with teachers, receiving initiation and transmission. It also talks mm-hmm. about doubts that we may encounter. Did you read the story of the sheikh and the lamb's bladder in the book?
I don't recall it right now, but I might have. I read a lot of the book about 3 weeks ago, so.
Uh-huh. Simply put, it's a story about how teachers may test our trust in them. And
uh-huh.
the story was recounted to me by one of my teachers, whose name was Sangye Droma. She was a Sufi teacher and a great friend of mine. And she said that once a man went to a sheikh, a Sufi sheikh, for teaching. The sheikh was very simple, austere man who sat by himself in a mosque in a high state of meditation. And he was the only student. There was no one else around. And after visiting
I do remember this one. Yeah, that's funny, the smell. Yeah, go ahead.
It would be so amazing if my teacher had more disciples to receive his teachings. You know, the world should see this guy. And the following day, when the student showed up at the mosque, he was astonished to find the teacher surrounded by a throng of people. And thereafter, large crowds were coming every day. The media showed up with microphones and cameras. The sheikh had been discovered. You know, he was on magazine covers. So now the student could barely see the teacher. He couldn't talk to him anymore. It was really at a distance. And he became sad and discouraged over several weeks and started to say to himself, God, I miss the old days when it was just me and the sheikh sitting around the mosque, talk every day. I wish all these people would just go away. That was his inner thought. And the next day when he returned to the mosque, he noticed a strange thing, that whenever the sheikh moved, he made revolting farting noises, and people in the audience were holding their noses and complaining that the sheikh was nauseating. And they started yelling and cursing at him and calling him a fake and throwing fruit and tomatoes at him. And people started storming out of the room, out of the mosque.
Yeah.
And this guy's original student sat there in amazement as he watched the whole room empty out, because people were convinced this guy was too... He was not developed. He was not a real sage, because he smelled a bit. So suddenly the student was left alone in the room with the sheikh. And when they were alone, the sheikh pulled up his robe and revealed that he was hiding a lamb's bladder under his arm, which was made terrible noises and
smelled.
Terribly. So the sheikh said to him, I heard your request and granted your wish. All those people thought I was disgusting and began to denounce me and doubt me, but you never wavered. You sat here. You knew who I really am. So you weren't deterred by the apparent bizarre behavior. You didn't lose faith in me. So that's how I know you're really, you know, a deserving student.
Right, yeah.
I love that story.
That's a great story.
Pulled with Sangye Droma's unique flair. And so some teachers, they may defy our sense of what a teacher should look like. I mean, they're not just all pure holy men or holy women. So we have to look deeper at people to see who they really are. And we have to examine teachers. We have to examine their character. And most of all, their influence on us, how they make us feel inside.
So, you know, it could also be that if a teacher gets too many superficial followers, he would do something like that, start cursing or start, you know, behaving in a manner that would offend them in order to weed out the people that don't need to be there.
That's correct.
And I think that does happen. I mean, I've heard other stories like that.
Well, in many ways, we learn that faith is something that challenges our reason.
Sometimes right.
What we have faith in defies reason. That's a big mystery.
Well, we're coming up on the end of our hour. Would you like to give your contact information again?
Absolutely. I'm at gbogart7 at sbcglobal.net. And my two websites are www.dawnmountain.com, D-A-W-N, dawnmountain.com, describes my books, and gregbogart.net describes my counseling and psychotherapy services.
Well, thanks, Greg, for joining us. I appreciate the interview.
Well, thank you for having me. I've appreciated the conversation.
I've been interviewing Greg Bogart. His book, In the Company of Sages, The Journey of the Spiritual Seeker. He also has books on dreams and other topics on his website. And thanks so much for joining us on Temple of Health Radio Show. Please join us next week.